Blog Talk Radio.
Effects. We found you. Hello. And welcome to this episode. We've got a pretty good program lined up for you. If I do say so myself, the poetry today is something that has been sitting on my shelf, lingering right in front of me for such a long time. I came after the beat generation, you know, after the 50s, and my heyday was more of the late 60s, 70s, you know, when a lot of things were happening around the world and big questions were being asked. There was a broad reevaluation of what was going on around us. And In that moment where young eyes, relatively disconnected from the big systems and powers, were holding them out at arm's length and examining them, saying, "This is not right. Look where this is taking us." We know that crowd evolved and. Perhaps in some ways became more a part of the establishment than the people they were railing against at the time. But the idea has always lingered, the sense of evaluation. You, as took over, it became easier not only to compromise, but to understand the benefits of compromise. There was a simplicity. If you just could fall into line, find your go to school, find your 9 to 5, and enjoy the benefits. It was an odd period because there were things going on that weren't the sense of awareness about consequences wasn't so personal. It was institutional. Look at what you're doing. Look at what we are collectively doing, and look at the consequences of that kind of thinking. Of course, the predominant topic was wars in the Middle East, asking important questions. Why are we there? And of course, the military and the industrial military complex became more and more defined, and that's something that likes to linger in the background, not in the headlines. Doesn't do well in headlines in the front page, but yeah, there it was. And for the very, very first time, and people today will certainly appreciate it, for the very first time, there were cameras brought into the war zones. And we had news broadcasts coming from the front. So not only were people were looking at the wounded and talking about them as the courageous soldiers that they are and were, but we were seeing the horror. The post-traumatic stress disorder wasn't just a fabrication. It was happening. And it was happening, and we saw the reasons. We saw the causes of it, and it was horrible. And the indignity of what we were able to do, the amount of carnage. And still we see remnants of that floating around, but but there are, you know, more powerful, more persuasive kinds of elements. Don't look at that. That was all then. This is now. We're much, much better off today because we have so-called power and influence. We're going to talk about that a little bit later in the program, but what it did was changed for a time. It changed values, and that value, not in terms of a big sea change in the growth around the world, but there was an awareness that we weren't alone, and that what we did had bearing on other people. Remember, was it 1969? Help me here. We saw pictures of the Earth for the very first time from space. Oh, the ripple, it changed. It changed us. It changed our thinking. We can now see, you know, in the light, this blue pearl. And I thought, what an apt description. This is just sitting against this blackness. That was us. We had never seen it before. Technology took us to the moon in a very short period of time an ambition needed to be realized. There needed to be statements about the greatness that had more than a military power to define it. So to redefine it, we did. We, the world. Now, it was a nation that was willing to make the sacrifices to get there, and they are, for history, they will be acknowledged for that. Not only that, time moves on, as we know. But thinking happened? Well, you and I know that questions started to be asked, and it became harder. And then we learned collectively that we couldn't ignore certain things. We couldn't ignore the subjugation of people. We couldn't ignore inequality. I'm going to talk to you, and we'll get around to that. Masonry has been doing this for a lot longer, my goodness. Without proselytizing, you keep your own counsel, of course. You make your own decisions, but think about this: are you just living in in a sense of false confidence because you have beliefs that are only comfortable because they're familiar, and you've been from the ignorance is bliss school of thinking, we've seemed to have marched on and began to find that there's something far more necessary going on that we need in our life. Putting trust in major institutions has created suspicion, because when we found evidence to the contrary, it was hard to assimilate all of that. What do we do? Cognitive dissonance seemed to be in the drinking water for a long time, and I think in some aspects it still is. Now, how we think about ourselves in relation to one another, how we relate to great ideas and truths, that's undergoing a review that we never quite saw coming. But bringing the cameras to the battlefield still goes on around us because it's great idea. You know, there was an excitement to it, but it showed that there's a hell of a lot of ugliness going on. Now, if we dwell on that, it does something to our psyche and changes us. We become more suspicious and more worrisome, and then we have to go live a life trying to justify all of that stuff. But there is that sense in the back of my mind. A lovely lady once would constantly remind me, Dale Graham, watch what you wish for because it might come true. And son of a gun, you want the truth? There it is. Yeah, I'm talking about what we pack around with us, not the truth that's curated for us, not the algorithms and the AI directing to our attention what somebody else or some other group thinks we ought to be thinking or doing, and not the constant pressure of the marketplace to buy something, you know, creating a need and then fulfilling it with some object. But this sense that of reality, a different sense of reality, it isn't necessarily pretty. When you think about it, it isn't pretty. But what to do? What to do? Well, what to do is to also notice that beauty and sensitivity and understanding. Values that enrich our lives, whatever your values are not shoved off the shelf by these other notions, by truths. They are still there, we begin to become aware that if we want to live a particular way of life with a particular to evaluate the world and find some element of satisfaction, then we have to be active about it because it's just not something that happens in a passive state. We can do that if we understand it. And to understand it means, of course, understanding who in the world we are. My goodness, back to everybody having their own story. So I guess, you know, it's not a utopian dream. Anyway, Thomas More, yeah, I'd like to sit down with Thomas and maybe he would get me a pint and we'll have this talk about the extent of that utopian dream where it's a lessening. It's not an accomplishing something. It's a lessening. In order to achieve a sense of what More described as utopia, We surrender. It's compromise. No, what happens if we learn the art of compromise? Do we necessarily need to find that utopian that entropy? No, because that's not likely to happen. I don't know if anybody is ever out there saying, you know, we will galvanize. We will come together on the major existential issues of our time. I don't hear that yet. We ought to, and there's things going on around now that are compelling. How dare you and I to find some level of positive thread, some progress through the truths of arts and sciences? How dare us to turn away from superstition and infidelity, you know, how dare us to do that? Everybody's getting away with it, aren't they? Just, you know, there's only, the law only matters when you're caught. Well, we find that those are people that are living in the prison that has invisible bars. It's interesting if you can create a prison where people don't realize they're in prison. They're quite happy. But the idea that there's this brotherhood that's walked the fine edge for so long, and recognizing what's going on and holding judgment, not being rash about what they find. When you find that there's something, you know, just abhorrent happening, we begin to deconstruct, go upstream in a sense, and look at where this began and what does it say. And when we get to it's time and time again, a lot of people will get to the point where we will be stopped because those are questions that we cannot answer. Well, just because we don't have an answer today is no reason not to explore and to search for an answer. Well, if we don't have the answer, then ladies and gentlemen, what about the second best answer? In the sense that we are connected, that we function on spectrums, that the universe isn't black and white and opposite. It's continuations. We balances that are created, yin yang. What's happening inside the molecule doesn't exist because everything is like-minded. It's this these relationships that have formed, and they're sustainable, and they're in motion, and we are too. We are too. So stop there. Put a pin in it. And we get the chance to look at today some poetry that will, like I said, not the Beat Generation, but the when you're handed some of the material, some of the great science fiction writers of the time were Stinson, Stanislaw Lem, Heinlein, you know, Ursula Le Guin, there were some remarkable things happening. We had access because publication, we had access. And we were reading, and you had the so-called underground newspapers and underground media. The music was a bit different. The material was a bit different, a bit edgier. Everything was a little bit edgier. And that hasn't changed. Maybe it's darkened in some people's minds. There's become where there's you know, people moving, closing the curtain. Don't look behind the curtain. It always raises a sense of suspicion. But what we have done is kept that curtain open, so people can look behind it with us. And what do they find are workers at the table? You can come into the Alchemist's laboratory with us if you choose. If you're thinking that this is, you know, if you're chasing some kind of a quick gain, it's not going to work for you. We're busy and we're knowledgeable, and we work in metaphor and we work in symbol, but so do chemists and so do mathematicians. You know, who doesn't in a way? Who finds the reality? Well, it's that bunch over there, those philosophers that are taking that on. And then you might easily say, you listen to philosophers and you listen to mathematicians, and they sound the same. They sound the same. How in the world does that happen? Wasn't one supposed to be soft and the other be hard? That's hard science. It's mathematics. Well, if that's the way you think, you're missing a little bit of the story. Missing so much more. Today, we're going to get into some of the poetry of the period. J.R.R. Tolkien. There. Said it out loud. And all that. If you haven't read the work, then I can only say it's like, you know, if you read the book and then you see the play or you see the movie, you notice that they're a little bit different. So same thing with Tolkien's work. You read his work, it's magnificent. What a fantasy. But then you know that he was part of a literary group at Oxford. And that met for years and years. He worked on this for, 12 years? And it took urging, because he was never quite finished, the old rascal. That's the plight of scholarship, you know. You're never quite finished. You can always add another thought in there. or rewrite. And it was, it took his friends around him to urge him to cajole, to demand that he take his work to the publishers. And the rest is what we have, a magnificent body of work that it elicits so much moral authority. So much moral authority is packed in the work. I would say I talked to somebody that is found that the work of William Shakespeare was tedious and painful, and it was a chore, often, you know, forced on you by people that didn't understand context themselves, and so you had these ideas thrust on you without the context. Now, yeah, if you and I were at Eton or Cambridge or Oxford or Wessex, you know, we'll find that we'll have a university college. We'll find somebody will be able to explain the context. So it has meaning. But without that, today, you and I can find the context. When we don't, it's a little oddity. If we see something and, you know, there's, and it seems to have had met the test of time, we can ask the context. Well, how does it have a bearing? Well, to do that, to find that, we dip into our studies. We start to read. We talk to other people. And we begin to evaluate for ourselves the bearing that certain ideas have on us. As my lovely old friend, who's no longer with us, but is with us, Michael would say, you can only influence the one next to you. And it has a ripple. It's like throwing a pebble into a still pond. It ripples. So we're going to ripple away here in this program, the commentary. Oh, I just think this is good. Yeah, a path, not the path, but an interesting path nevertheless. I was thinking more about the nature of what it is we're doing, this deep dive into understanding what's going on around us. Sit back and enjoy today. Fill up your mug with whatever is hot and comfortable or cool and soothing, and join us. We have some music, I hope, will put your mind at ease, just to help, you know, it's my version of contemplation. We'll start with a bit of Paul Desmond. And of course, last week I talked to you about this little bomb that we have. We're going to start to scratch the surface of anti-Masonic sentiment. How's that for a piece of history? Paul Desmond, Feeling Blue, 1996. Holy, my goodness. Thank you. Well, one of my favorite parts of the program, commentary. The title, A Path, not the path, but an interesting path nevertheless. This is this talks about, it's my way of tipping into the whole idea of enlightened idealism. We're going to hear that term a little bit later in the show. A truly lovely man once told me he had to sell his boat because when he walked by, it yelled at him to take it out when he had other things to do. And it was so stressful, he sold the boat. And yes, he liked the tranquility of boating. This is a man tuned to the harmony of life, experimenting with it. I can't imagine living in a world that stops because I've told myself I'm overwhelmed. Why, if that were the case, I'd never circle big challenges before leaping. I'd just quit. I wasn't built with the divine in mind. That came later after I turned away from stereotypes and began questioning. The media assaults my sense each minute of each day with alarm. Advertisers or politicians, it doesn't matter. They attempt to manipulate, except with people like me, they forgot. I can turn it all off in an instance, all of it. And you are right to ask, if you stop and step out of the mainstream, what's left? What's left are decisions about decisions. Better to find the best influences than to make it up as I go along. Discovering I was a man of faith, but not of organized religion, took time. I had little idea why I was drawn to fountains and quiet spots, why I could while away time with a thermos and a book or fished with an unbaited hook. I guess like you, I can admit I needed confirmation. Acknowledgement. Higher level education is lifelong. That's not something that's institutionalized. That's within. University taught how to study, how to digest and organize thoughts. But there are other ways to learn that. How to research, and best of all, how to read a subject. Though at the time you could not convince me a year was short, but as an old man, I can tell you a single year is like the blink of an eye. Time passes quicker, even for old men who take their sweet time to die. Faced with ideals, we have much to think about. Can we trust our own senses to invest our valuable time to make the examination of the world a craft? I'll let you know when I'm done. And so it goes, and so it goes. Imagine Keith Jarrett, just this beautiful talent, just a remarkable talent. And I know it's, you hear him at the keyboard. He does get carried away, and I love that. I love that kind of intensity. Are you ready? Are you ready? Let me try and do justice to somebody that I think is just a remarkable influence. And when I think about this work, I am caught with this sense of amazement and wonder, and I'm left realizing after the fact what I'm learning, what is being taught, the values and principles that are being taught. I'm talking about none other than John Ronald Reuel Tolkien. This is a fellow that was born in 1892, and he passed away in 1973, the year I entered university. Now, I was one of those people that shouldn't have ever thought about university, not from my social rank. No, people around my entire generations didn't go to school, didn't go that far. You went out and found a job, and anything else was impractical. But going into a prolonged education and paying for it, are you out of your mind? And buying your own books, this is just unheard of. And what are you studying? So to discover this kind of thing was, for me, an opening. I had no idea. Now, I'll just go through this. I don't know how to go through this briefly, but to get to the poem that he wrote. But I think the story, this is his story, and you have a similar story. It's thought that his family was of German origin, and his dad was a banker, he was a bank clerk, and he went to South Africa in the 1890s to get promotions. It still happens. People in the banking industry, when they're starting out, they'll move all over the place because it helps their career, and they can take on greater and greater responsibilities commensurate with their abilities. So John, who is known by it wasn't called J.R.R. he was known by Ronald within the family. He grew up for a certain period of time. He was living in Africa, and he had a close encounter that he talked about this great hairy spider, as you can imagine. Shows up later in his reading, doesn't it, in his work. And the 15th of February, 1896, his dad died. And he and his mother, who was from the Midlands in England, West Midlands, and his younger brother Hilary returned to England. So now, his journey took him to, it said here in this analysis, that Tolkien's family life was generally lived on the genteel side of poverty. And if you've been there, it's a consciousness is always there. Enough to eat, but enough. But the situation worsened in 1904 when his mom was diagnosed with diabetes. And in those days, pre-insulin, she died. She died in November that year. And that meant that Tolkien and his brother were orphaned. So they were passed through family, unsympathetic family members, and eventually were given to lodge with under the watchful eye of a priest who took care of them body and soul, and they were safe. And so he was showing that he had a remarkable gift for linguistics, and he mastered Latin and Greek. He was about 15, 16 years old. And that was the basis for arts education at the time. But he was very, very competent in a number of other languages, modern and ancient, notably Gothic, and later Finnish. Well, Finnish, you know, is like a standalone language. You know a little bit about it. Standalone. To try and find the root of the Finnish language. But he was making up, around that time, he was already making up his own languages. And he had a literary group that he associated with, writers and people that went on to become quite famous, poets and writers. And they met regularly at a tea house. We called it a tea club, Boravian Society. He had a name for it. And then he struck up a relationship with a young girl who was just a few years. He was only 16 at the time. She was older. The priest saw what was going on. I said, no, Father Francis said, no, you stay until you're 21. This is, you know. So what did he do? He stuck to it. He said, no, I'll agree. And so he had to reconstitute that relationship, which he did later successfully with Edith. He didn't do well. He didn't do well in honors moderations of a 4-year Oxford classics course. But he had an outstanding alpha plus in philology. And so he changed his school from classics to English language and literature. And one of the poems he discovered in the course of the Old English Studies was Christ of Cynewulf. And he was, it would translate to Hail Arendel, brightest of angels, or Middle Earth sent to men. Yeah. Anybody here that's been familiar with the work, whether you've read The Hobbit, or he did that in what, 1937, I think that one came, was published, and then Lord of the Rings, the trilogy. But his friends, he became, in Oxford, he became part of a group known as the Inklings. I love this. And it had to do with writing. And the boys in this, Coghill, Dyson, Owen Barfield, Charles Williams, C.S. Lewis, they became very, very close friends. And these are the guys, particularly Lewis, that leaned in and said, get this manuscript published, man. It's good. He'd been working on it for years and he was teaching. Anyway, in the 60s, this caught on. For whatever reason, this was the time of Arthur C. Clarke, Stanley Kubrick. The Lord of the Rings came out. About the time of psychedelia came up, was on the market. 2001, A Space Odyssey, even if you've seen that at the time, mind-blowing, literally, figuratively. But they would come to his house, fans of his would come to his house and just stand and stare. Just stare. They wanted to know whether Frodo had succeeded or failed in the quest. they were reading, and they went to the author because they were getting ahead. This became a cult, not just of Tolkien, but of fantasy literature. The people were taking this very, very, very seriously. So he retired in 1959, after he passed away, his son, who also a literary, had some literary significance, Christopher Tolkien, published the Silmarillion. Had to put it together and publish it. And then he introduced the Book of Lost Tales. Lots of material. This man was prolific. He just kept writing and writing and writing. Anyway, what caught my eye here was that he wrote poems. And, of course, he put the poems in his storyline. And this comes from the Two Towers. You're familiar with those of you who are familiar with the format. And this is from The Departure of Boromir. And this is a narrative that picks up after Frodo and Sam have left the rest of the Fellowship and headed toward Mordor to destroy the Ring. And Aragorn is racing in pursuit, chasing them down. And he finds it difficult to find the Hobbit's tracks. And suddenly Aragorn hears the voices of orcs going into battle. Orcs is what the Ukrainians are calling Russian soldiers these days, the orcs. And they follow a battle horn of Boromir, this human warrior in the Fellowship. Aragorn is afraid that Boromir is in danger, and the orcs wound Boromir fatally, and when Aragorn reaches him, Boromir is nearly dead. But he confesses to having tried unsuccessfully to take the ring from Frodo earlier, and then he dies, and Aragorn weeps over his friend's body. So, more, far more, but check this out. This is the song of, and you're going to, this is called the Song of Aragorn. And it picks up on a theme, and if any of you are familiar with A Merchant of Venice and all that controversy, and you'll remember that this line, all that glisters is not gold. And keep that in mind. Here he opens, all that is gold does not glitter. Not all those who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. From the ashes a fire shall be woken. A light from the shadows shall spring. Renewed shall be blade that was broken. The crownless again shall be king. What do my friends that are studying down that rabbit hole of the occult, what are they, the esoteric thought, what are they, what do they make of this type of thing? What do they make of fantasy in terms of the explanations? Yeah. As you digest that a little bit, here's some jazz from the 20s and 30s. This is Benny Carter. Thank you. Did I mention already my sense that the greatest, one of the most significant influences and powers, if you will, is indifference? If you think about it, it's the complete resolution. You want to know how you're over something, like you've resolved it in your own being, in your own mind. It's when it's the topic or the hint, the bare suggestion is met with indifference. It is what it is. Neither happened or didn't happen. Indifference. We can crave fear. I'll get your attention. I'll make you all look up here. Because if you don't, I will hurt you in some way. Follow me because I'm a celebrity, because I say so. And some of that will extend to you. And so in your meager life, you can be a celebrity too. You have that sense of self-importance. Or there is this other group that says, my life's not meager. It is what it is. And for you to say that, okay, that's cynical of you. But there's far more to me, far more to life. And don't be so quick to judge me as if this whole journey isn't over. And when it is, are you going to presume that you understand? Because I sure as hell don't. Between us, one of us is the expert on the self and the other one is just an observer. Oh, yes, we need the observations to help us round out and understand more about ourselves. But ultimately, the person, the man who's been with himself every second of his life is probably the expert. Now, what does he do with it? How does he handle all of that information? Put a pin in that just for a second. This is history. And remember, we're looking at coming up to the 1800s. This is like 1789. We're looking at the pressure points within Amsterdam and in The Hague. Nationalism on one hand and this sense of insecurity brought on by republicanism. And on the horizon, we have writers and theorists that are talking about our relationship with power. And remember, it's the Parliament, the civil wars in England were well known. The beheading the king was well known, what happened? Cromwell was known, and Richard II was known. Anyway, Charles II, sorry. Here we open with the anti-Masonic literature. And this is, it's not, if you're thinking of something salacious coming out of this, I'm sorry. The anti-Masonic literature used cautiously helps us understand what contemporaries perceived. True, eh? True. However imperfectly, about the political meaning in Masonic rhetoric and ritual. You want a clearer understanding. You look at what the critics were saying about it. We can now also see, after our discussion of Scottish, English, and Dutch Freemasonry, the political and social meaning given to these new private fraternities by their members. For them, the lodges could function as idealized polities. Civil yet private. In that idealization lay a tension barely beneath the surface between the private and the public. Some men probably never sought to apply what they learned about self-governance anywhere but in the lodges. Others could seek more and reason by analogy to the larger society. If the lodge constituted a new private space, located somewhere between the public and strictly private, that is, personal and domestic, might it not have become another kind of extended family? The lodges might have evolved into purely social and leisured, increasingly one of the most many pastimes of the genteel and the educated. The admission of women into some of the lodges might indeed have said to signal just such a turn away from the civic and governmental. Or we can argue the lodges for women and men, as well as Masonic emphasis on the lodge as possessing a domestic life, permit us to gauge more closely and exactly how the lodges intertwined the private and the public. And in so doing, they gave enlightened idealism a personal and hence more intense meaning. Particularly on the continent, Masonic rhetoric often referred to the activities of the lodges as domestic, to authority as paternal, to neighboring lodges as sisters, to lodges from which they originated as mothers. The relationship between the master of a lodge and his brothers had emotional overtones that 18th century men expressed through the metaphors that were personal and domestic. A Dutch master in the 1760s addressed his brothers, "From his heart, I recommend the interest of the lodge to you with ardor." And the paternal love from the brother members. In the same period, a grief-stricken brother wrote of his mother, Lodge, at the death of his wife in childbirth, and his ardent wish that the child who had been saved will see the light with you, my tenderly loved mother, la bien-aimée. That's the Lodge. The Lodge responded with compassion, referring to his deceased wife as our sister, although she was almost certainly not a member of the Women's Lodge. And later in the century, an Amsterdam orator introduced his sons as candidates for admission with the moving story of how one of them had saved him from drowning. He knew of no more appropriate way to reward his valor than to offer them both membership as equals in his fraternity. Private realm men spoke with emotion about their devotion to the lodge and to one another. At their festivals, Masonic orators spoke of the celebration that today unites the immense family of Masons. One of the few excuses a member could offer for being negligent of his duties or for requesting honorary membership aside from travel abroad was family and domestic affairs. The idea of the domestic was ultimately connected to the ambience and values of the lodge. Yet, it was intended to be a separate sphere. Predictably, lodges often chose women as their symbols. Minerva was a favorite, and Masonic iconography made much of her. She could be wisdom or enlightenment. She could also symbolize a republic. Le Bien-Aimée chose for its emblem a woman gray with old age, wearing a white veil. Her age was meant to symbolize the antiquity of true friends and our noble order. Every item she wore, every posture and gesture of her hands, was endowed with a carefully described symbolism. She was, among her many virtues, a faithful wife. Ah, the metaphor. Don't be too troubled. Masonry, where I am, Masonry is going through a life phase. And this has happened before, and it will happen again. You know, we don't stop the progress of life going on around us just because we don't understand or we're caught unawares. We're not anticipating. And it's hard to anticipate because it seems so frivolous and unnecessary. Why trouble ourselves with something that hasn't happened yet? Well, that's like planning ahead in a way. If I'm going on a long journey, I think it's frivolous not to plan where I'm going to stop, where I'm going to stay overnight, or where I'm going to have a chance to, if I'm going to have a chance to eat and replenish and sleep. So that's advanced planning, and it hasn't happened yet, but it seems wise. It seems practical and sensible. Just like if I'm moving into an area, I want a clean source of water, a clean and reliable source of water. These things aren't so ancient anymore, are they? We see the entire Middle East is torn up. And if we trace back the root of it, it seems, whether we're looking at, I won't get into naming countries, but water, an ancient battle for control of water is at the heart of it. And now the environment has captured our attention, as it ought to have done. And the shortcomings of our thinking a long, long time ago are coming back to us. But once upon a time, when in the 50s and 60s and 70s, we were doing things and enjoying them because we could basically ignore the downside. And it was a period of tremendous change. So a cigarette and a coffee, the perfect breakfast, nope. And yet, did it stop people from using nicotine? No. But it certainly now, you know, it seems rare. It's only a small percentage of people that still have that addiction. But we know far more about it, and we're aggressively and actively treating it. It's a problem. We're using our lakes as toilets. And that's coming back to haunt us now. And we know all the wildlife, all the things living in that environment have been contaminated. And now we're becoming aware of things that have happened, you know, when the Chernobyl meltdown happened, that nuclear core went up into the atmosphere, and people have been inhaling tritium for a long, long time. Tritium? Yeah, I think. And then when we see these outbreaks of cancers around the world, I don't know if we want to get into that kind of a reality, do we? That kind of connection, causality, boy, that would be quite revealing. Today, our responsibilities are being brought to our attention, which is perfectly fine for people that are able to think and embrace the greater good, which many of us of the craft have been taught is an element of a virtuous life. So carry on. You can be bleak and morose if that's your nature, but things are serious. And this is when the things are serious, we can run around with jazz hands flapping, and some men will go off with their, because they're feeling they're on overload, but there are always men who are able to control their emotion. They're not overwhelmed with it or the situation, thank goodness, are able to think practically and with some forbearance about what needs to be done. Now, unfortunately, I guess for me, it's unfortunate that the reality is there are men who will always push back, because they haven't learned to trust themselves. So my goodness, they don't trust themselves, can't trust anybody else. So that is a fact of life. But does that stop progress and reasoning through and finding solutions to problems? No, never has. When I say that indifference is more powerful, it's even more powerful than confusion. It certainly is. And the beauty of masonry is that it sits down very comfortably and we'll have that conversation with you. If you look through, you can have that conversation through the lens of Freemasonry, the influences and what influences and how, and the influences on us. And how dare us to prevail in these times of difficulty? Well, I think the world has always been difficult, but we have these little devices that are bringing it to our attention. And the truth, well, my goodness, here we are living with truths. And what does it do? Well, we scratch our head and wonder, how do we sort this out? Can this all be, what I'm seeing and hearing, it's happening. And the nonsense and trying to, the subterfuge that, and people trying to make profit off of our insecurities, that's all real. It's been going on for a long, long time. But don't lose track of the thread. Don't lose track of this level of goodness. 1,000 years from now, the archaeologists are going to be scraping away at the surface, and they're going to find this level. It's going to be marked in the archaeological dig. And what they're going to find is this gentility. They're going to find the sensibility, the refinement of thinking, an enlightened reasoning. Is there all these other things? Yes, they're there too, but given the options, they're going to discover that there are people that, under the circumstance, and though they certainly didn't deserve it, were living well and living a fuller, a broader, more satisfying life. And how, the question I hope that the archaeologists will ask is, how did they manage it? And maybe it, amongst the relics that we leave behind, they'll find that ring on your finger and wonder, some graduate student doing work will scratch their head and say, I wonder what that means. Come back and see us in a week. It's been an absolute pleasure and great fun to connect with you again. Thanks, Middle East. Thank you very much for the response. My goodness, it's overwhelming. I'm pleased that you're able to join us and that you come back. And way over there in New Zealand, hello. Nice to have you connect with us. And China, I'm surprised in a way, pleasantly surprised that you guys have pulled up a chair and are sitting in. And I hope it opens up some avenues for us to connect around the world. Thanks. Thanks in Europe. Thank you much. Britain, as ever. And North America, lovely, lovely. Here, we'll finish off with a little Kenny Burrell, and I'll see you soon. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. Please, and include yourself, my goodness.